of all, it's always a pleasure to follow Marcus. I learned a lot from him, and I've tried to pattern my career after him. And he's the person I want to become. And I learned a lot, particularly today. I learned that it was acceptable to admit that one had forgotten what one had written. And since I forget, I forget everything I write, but I've never admitted it before. My students come up to me and they quote me on things, and I said, "Did I write that?" And they said, "Yes." I said, "God, I must have been smart at one point." The other thing I want to dispel is a nasty rumor that I've heard that UCLA is actually a branch campus of the University of Cincinnati. That turns out not to be true, despite what people at the University of Cincinnati would like to believe. This presentation will be up on the website, which you won't see here, but I have put on it. In the notes section of PowerPoint, I've written extensive descriptions with the idea that someone who hadn't actually seen me talk could actually understand it. And probably people who had actually seen me talk probably could actually understand it as well. I like quotes, and I ran across this one, so I thought I'd include it. I did that at a point where I thought I didn't have enough to say. Now, the other thing was right. But it does actually sort of give you an idea of how I look at these things. I like to characterize myself as an applied theoretician. I do a lot of work on the ground helping police and other people actually solve real problems. And then I do other stuff which is more academically inclined, and I like to think these two things interact. I want to also start off with a sort of irreverent, but I think relevant, personal comment. I discovered the other day that I'm old enough now that I actually have know some history, or experienced it. And when I was an undergraduate and taking my first criminology class, at the University of Michigan, I discovered that I hated it. It was a subject in which I could get an A without ever having read anything, and feeling the textbook was a complete disappointment. And only later on came back into criminology when I discovered that the sociologists were on the run. And I was trained primarily more as an economist, although never got a degree in it. So I have a tendency to think that way. I don't particularly like academic disciplines. I like problems, and I think the important thing is to figure out how to solve problems. I don't really give a crap about what discipline people come from. And I suspect, as other people have said before, that one of the reasons we have not made much progress against crime is because we've been subject to the sociological discipline. And there's some important exceptions to this. I think Marcus is a good example of somebody who does have a sociological background but actually can think. And I think most of the progress we've made in studying crime is made by invasions of other disciplines. Unfortunately, they've been often naive, uncooperative, and short. They're sort of like Viking raids on the coast of France, where they sort of burned a few outlying villages and then disappeared after taking the easy loot, and then lost interest. And really what we want are people from other disciplines to invade, settle down, intermarry, and breed, and create a whole new society. With that, I want to say welcome, barbarians. Hope you stay around for a long time. What I want to talk about are sort of warnings about, you know, what every barbarian should know if you want to stay around and breed. Jeff asked me to talk about police, and I have to admit, I thought, oh God, this is so boring. I wasn't really interested. I was interested in crime problems, but I have to thank Jeff for doing this, because actually when I started doing it, it turned out to be some very interesting problems that come up, so it turned out to be a lot of fun. Let me describe how I'm thinking about this. I think about the simulating police as a subset of simulating crime. And this will come up in a variety of forms. There were some earlier attempts at simulating policing strategies based on a form of policing, which I'll describe in a moment. And that form of policing is now largely discredited. So what I'm going to talk about are the policing strategies, so that if you're interested in simulating police, you can think about four basic kind of strategies. I'll focus primarily on two of them. I'm going to lay out a broad framework for simulating policing that would apply to all of these strategies, or at least three of them. And then I'm going to focus primarily on two of the strategies, focused policing and problem-oriented policing. Now, a number of years ago, I was fortunate enough to be asked to serve on the National Academy of Sciences panel to look at police research and practice. And we produced a report called Policing, Fairness, and Effectiveness, or something like that. The citations to all this stuff, by the way, are on the PowerPoint. When you pull it down, you can find it. David Weisberg and I were the co-chairs of the section that dealt with police effectiveness issues, and Dave and I wrote an article later on about this, and this is adapted from the National Academy report and from our thing. Basically, there are four strategies, the now discredited strategy, which we call the standard model, you can think of it as having three, this is a stool with three legs, none of which turned out to be particularly robust. One is that randomly roaming around actually can reduce crime, and if you have more randomly roaming around, you will reduce crime. The limited information we have on that from fairly old studies suggests that's not true. Second part is that if you follow up on an investigation of a crime, you can solve them. Turned out that really it's very difficult, largely because you don't have a huge amount of control of the amount of information available. And the third is if you get there fast, you can make a lot of arrests, and that turns out also not to be true because citizens don't report things fast enough. Yeah?
So a naive question about the patrolling part. If I understand you correctly, you're saying that if you increase the number of patrols, it didn't seem to affect anything?
Right, right.
I mean, there has to be some threshold.
Let's come back to this. Yeah. Very quickly, if you have no police, like the police go on strike, all right, you'll have a lot of crime. Then when the police come, yes, absolutely. But I'm talking about in the normal way we experience it, with marginal increases or decrements in patrol forces. In that range, we have not found detectable changes. There are some real limitations of these studies, which I really don't want to get into in general meeting. I'm more than happy to talk with you about them later. Or if you really want to lead a very boring life or need to get to sleep fast, there's... You can read our National Academy report. Richard, it was a fun thing, experience, but it was written by a committee and suffers all the aspects of that. Anyway, that's sort of, you can think of that as sort of the baseline of policing. Right? This was sort of, all police agencies to some degree use these kind of things, although to a varying extent they de-emphasize them. Politicians and the news media think fast response still works. It's hard to disabuse them of that notion, no matter how you tell it to them. And television, of course, pays attention to the investigations part, which demonstrates its utility immediately. A lot of attention has been given to community policing. It's hard to define. It involves some kind of partnering between members of the community and the police. And what community means and what partnering means is unclear. There's a lot of public interaction, building support. Problem. For our purposes, it is highly ambiguous and it raises some issues about how to deal with it. It's also ambiguous in terms of its effectiveness. The limited evidence we have suggests that certain forms of community policing reduce fear, but it probably has little or no impact on crime directly, at least in general. And I'm painting with a big brush here. Focused policing has received a lot of research attention, particularly the hotspots patrol, the idea that you can identify high, intense clusters of crime. You're sending your police to that, sitting on that for even limited amounts of time, actually can reduce crime. There's some randomized controlled trials of that seem to work. Offender investigations have received relatively limited research attention. I was surprised by this when we were doing a literature review for this. I thought this was going to be a pretty solid body of evidence. It turned out not to be the case. So it's unclear, but it's still, I would say, it is logical. It makes a certain amount of sense. And then there's a lot of information out of the UK about repeat victimization, focusing on people who've already been victimized, making sure they don't victimized. Again, there's a lot of good evidence that that exists and that, that attacking repeat victimization works. So this is a fairly effective approach overall. And then the problem-oriented policing up here combines the highly specific nature along this dimension and the use of a broad range of interventions along here. It is generally highly specific in terms of how it focuses from a problem-oriented policing perspective. One doesn't focus on crime, one focuses on a very particular form of crime. The Center for Problem-Oriented Policing, for example, has a series of problem-specific guides. One of my students and I wrote one on preventing college drinking riots. It's a very specific kind of problem. I have another student working on vehicle pedestrian accidents. There's a lot of analysis. Basically, you could think about this as sort of street-based approach to science, application of science. The interventions are highly tailored to the particular conditions that one is interested in reducing. So the kind of things you would do to reduce thefts from automobiles in a particular parking garage might be very different than you would do for the theft of vehicles on the street. And there's an evaluation component, find out whether it was effective. So those are sort of the broad strategies that we identified in this review. What I've done here is basically give you my sort of gut instinct about the utility of approaching these things from a simulation point of view. I'm going to start with community policing. I'm going to throw this one out completely. I don't think community policing is defined with enough clarity that you can actually do much with it from a simulation point of view. The goals are unclear, the mechanisms are unclear, and until somebody can define it or a form of it with some specificity, it's just not conducive to doing anything. That's not to say that it's useless from a practical point of view. It's just I don't think the kind of things we would be interested in would help us much here. The standard model I will talk about, my worry is that people will get stuck here because it's really a simple thing to simulate, so it's easy to do and won't get lost in the minutia and never get out. And, a whole generation of graduate students who write their dissertations on estimating some peculiar coefficient of something or other, which has absolutely no consequence for larger policing. I will use it as a background part of a larger simulation. So I'm going to focus on these two here on the right side, primarily. That's where I'll spend most of my attention. I think the potential for focus policing is high, although I think that they're potentially simple, but still very useful. Problem-oriented policing is a very difficult thing to simulate. I think it's but it has a heck of a lot of potential, and it's important for those types of simulations to think about where the simulator stands relative to the police. And I'll come back to this briefly. One form of simulation of problem-oriented policing, the simulator is outside the police and looking at the police. In another form, they're essentially partnered with the police and looking at a common problem they're both working on. And as I said, I'll come back to that. So where you stand relative to the problem is going to be an important thing there. There are basically four principles that I want to talk about here. I think about the problem or pattern or the change in those things as being the outputs. We're interested in crime, primarily. Although with a problem-oriented approach, there's a lot of other things you could simulate besides crime, traffic accidents being one of them. I also talk about errors in the data, and so you have to model the errors themselves in order to do some of these things. As I mentioned before, standard policing are going to take as part of the background part of the simulation, much like you would the street network. And then you want to then model the intervention of the mechanisms. This is the basic framework I was thinking about after Jeff asked me to do this, that what I would suggest is you start with a simulation of the crime problem or pattern. And a number of the presentations that are being discussed today will talk about various forms of that kind of thing. Police at that stage are not involved in the simulation at all. The second thing is that I will argue that we need a reporting, recording, filtering model that models errors. And the reason for this is if we just do this, the output is the God's eye view of the crime pattern. All crimes get reported. When we look at the distribution of crimes, we think of the computer simulation as our world and we're the God, right? We see everything, and if we choose not to see it, it's a conscious choice. We're just not going to look at that output. But from the police point of view and from the public's point of view, they only see a limited part of that. That's a different, potentially a different image. And we need to be able to sort of compare these. And as you can imagine, this is a huge issue for calibration and validation issues, because this might not look like that. And I'll come back to these in a moment. Then there would be some, so that here's this simulation of the police standard operations, and it would get input from the after this recording filter is introduced. And there might be some feedback here. And if standard policing worked well, we would expect feedback here. I've added that for charity purposes. There's also, for problem-oriented policing, this simulation of problem interventions, which I hope will become clear in a moment. That's the basic view. Let me talk a little bit about the filtering calibration issue. The problem with data in our field is sometimes perplexing to people from outside of it. I suspect it is there are analogous issues in other fields as well. Paleontologists, for example, don't have a complete access to the fossil records, and the ones they get are not a random collection of those that could have been left. So basically, if you think of what the simulation provides is a description of all crime events, but in reality, only a subset of those are reported to the police, right? And when the police get them, based on the information they get from citizens and their own nefarious purposes, they may classify them in any number of ways, some of which you might think of as errors. Let me give you a hypothetical. One form of focused policing involves this notion of the CompStat process, which basically has been pioneered by New York and I think is being used extensively in LA. I have a friend who sends me clippings from New York all the time where the police union is accusing the police administration of misclassifying the crime reports in order to make themselves look good. Leaving aside whether that accusation is true or whether that's part of some internal politics between the union and the administration, let's just pretend it's true for the moment, because you can see readily what the problem is. If a thing comes in and it's a burglary and then it gets classified as a theft and you're modeling burglaries, you're going to miss something, right? There's a lot of things, other errors that can creep into it, but these are probably the two biggest ones. The fact that a lot of crimes are not reported to police and then they can be classified in odd ways. So you might have a series of burglaries, and then you have a rape, which turns out the rape was a burglar breaking into a place, finds a woman at home, rapes her. That gets classified now as a rape, which is not part of the burglary series. On the other hand, also, if you're interested in the rape series, the burglary pattern may be part of that. So just drawing down data will not help you identify this. As I said, I like quotes, and I like Leonard Cohen, and this seemed particularly appropriate. Now, one of the things that we do know is that there's a lot of repeats, repeat victimization has gotten a lot of attention, particularly from my UK colleagues. But let me tell you, here's a big mystery. Maybe someone from the UK actually has an answer to this, but everyone I've asked in the United States who pretends to know something about victimization survey results claims that they have never heard of such a thing. That's sort of a biased sample in itself. But if we have if reporting of the next crime is at least partially dependent on how many crimes you've been victimized before, then we could end up with quite different views on what the real crime pattern is, depending on the relationship. If people are reticent to report their first crime, but as they get used to it, they report more and more of them as they're repeated victimized, as an A, then what we probably have in our looking at recorded crime statistics is an over emphasis on repeat victimization. But if people stop reporting or cut off reporting after subsequent victimizations, which I suspect is probably more likely, this one here, then actually crime is highly more concentrated than we estimate. Okay, and then C would be basically it's constant, doesn't really matter, and we can imagine different sort of population heterogeneity in which different populations report at a constant rate regardless of prior victimization. And there's probably other variations on this theme, but I want to put this up here to draw attention to this problem and the fact that I don't think at this point we really have an answer to this question. You're nodding your head. Am I right? I'm just guessing here. What my standard practice is to wing it and then see if someone will contradict me.
I know a colleague of mine wrote a PhD, especially on reporting to the police, and also she said it's unknown whether...
Oh, good. So someone's actually looked at it as wonderful.
So I completely agree.
Thank you. Anyway, so, I mean, that's an empirical question as much as anything else, but there might be some modeling that one might do to say, if it acts this way, then what would the effect be? If it acts something else, what would the effect be? And perhaps getting a handle on that. Standard policing. The basic idea here is that you would have some kind of input, some crime is happening, goes to the reporting filter, using these mysterious processes, which we don't have any information about, and then... the police do something here. The simulation is more patrols, less patrols, or faster responses to things, and then you see if that has an effect on crime. That's the basic idea. So one might imagine that what has a simulation where crimes are occurring, and that you have police agents roaming around, and every time a crime occurs. The computer says, okay, it's reported or not reported. If it's not reported, the police don't do anything because they don't know about it. If it is reported, the nearest car zooms to that location, right? And you could find out whether faster zooming had an effect, right? Mm-hmm. Those kind of things. Or stopping response, if that had any effect. Those are the kind of simulations one might want to do. Here's some of the things I was talking about, speed of response, density of police patrols. You could also look at what happens if you remove offenders. So you have a population of offenders roaming around, police are making arrests. Does the arrest actually reduce crime in some kind of removal? And then offenders, of course, are not instantly rehabilitated, despite what some of my colleagues would like to believe. They would have to be reintroduced, right? And then one could also vary the way the police interact with the error generation. So if the police, and here's where community policing might be able to sneak its nose into this thing. You can imagine a simulation which said, the willingness to report depends on relationships with the police. Perhaps we could improve that, and that would then increase reporting. What would crime look like? So that might creep in here. Let's look at focus policing here. Now, here I've sort of snuck in something which I think is particularly important. And this is a sort of a crime analysis module. So we have, again, the crimes occurring. They go through this error production process here. And then we have the crime analysis unit. It's a simulation of it. And in this particular simulation, the crime analysis unit is basically, you can think of them as just generating a hotspot map, right? And so here, the standard procedures would be, you might simulate going to the center of the mass, right? Or some other kind of thing. And then you'd see whether that had an effect on crime, right? And then you'd compare the human eye view to the God's eye view. That would be an example of that. Am I going too fast here? Are there any questions about this? Here's some things that one might want to look at. You simulate the crime analysis function. It detects hotspots, how, you know, different ways of responding to hotspots, how long you stay at a hotspot, how fast you get to it. You could vary a lot of the aspects around that. And you could also do analogous arrangements for offender networks and repeat victims. Because I got carried away with drawing things, I thought it would be easy. So instead of using a spatial geography, you might want to use some kind of network. So if you were simulating investigations, instead of having a crime map, you'd have a network, and the crime analysis unit is trying to figure out who's involved in the network, and they allocate detectives in a particular way, which then takes out parts of the network, and then you could see whether the networks change. And for repeat victimizations, you might have a unit which focuses on identifying particular units or particular types of individuals who are susceptible to crime and doing something with them and seeing if those kind of hotspots change. Finally, the last part here is the simulating problem-oriented policing. A lot of the same process, but here you've got a simulation of problem analysis. Okay. Now, what this is actually the same thing as this, scaled down. So what you have to imagine is you're simulating the crime pattern. Then you have to say, how would the problem analyst in the police department simulate the same thing? Right? So, but they're basing it on the filtered crime, right? And then in the background is the standard operating stuff. And then they create a problem intervention. Now, this is going to create a lot of issues because the first two types of policing strategies are fairly generic. And you can basically say, well, there's a couple different things that they do, you know, going to hot spots or randomly patrolling around. And it's a fairly limited number of types of interventions. In the problem-oriented approach, the number of types of interventions is probably not infinite, but is huge. And it's not necessarily related directly to police. So the police role might simply be to get some other agency to do something they weren't doing before. So for dealing with drug markets, the police role might be to turn to the codes and compliance authority in the city and say, you need to reprioritize which houses you're going after and how you get to the landlords. So then you'd actually not be simulating the police response at all. You'd be simulating how codes and compliance goes after landlords. So the range of problem interventions is vast, and understanding the particular mechanism that was intended in these simulations would be vitally important. I'm trying to distinguish, and here, this is where I started losing myself in the morass of this thing, so I could easily have this thing really bollocks up, but I started thinking about two different kinds of simulations. One is the simulation of problem-oriented policing, and the other is the simulation of the problem and intervention. The problem simulation basically is involved in looking at how the problem is reduced. The problem or the policing simulation is looking at how policing in general is produced. And I, with the risk of muddling things up even further, I've created yet another graph. I think it pictures, but sometimes I'm not certain I think at all when I do these pictures. Let's think about it this way. Basically, the intervention simulation is this loop here. There's a problem, there's an intervention selection, a planning, and an evaluation, which comes back to the problem. And I'll come back with an example of that. In that kind of simulation, The simulator is essentially partnering with the police. They're saying, what is the problem we have here? What do we know about it? How can we best characterize it? How can we model it? What we can do if-then planning things. And the police do things, and you can compare their results to your simulated results. Or even before that, you can say, well, let's not even try this one because the simulation results look really bad. So here the simulator is actually part of the whole process. Right? And in this, the larger scheme of things, the simulator is standing outside the police. And they're looking at how the police themselves simulate the problem, how they use the kind of theories that Pat talks about, that Marcus talks about, that Ron Clark talks about, in understanding the problems. And so one of the things that we would be interested in from that point of view is if they misconstrued routine activity theory, would that reduce their ability to solve problems? If they did not adequately take into account many of the aspects of situational crime prevention, would that reduce? If they did not adequately address the street networks, would that reduce their ability to solve problems? So those kind of things would be looked at. So these are two very different types of simulations. At the risk of oversimplifying, this is sort of, this interior one is more of an applied approach, where the analyst is working directly with the cops and working on a particular problem. And the other is more of a pure science academic approach. I suspect both of them overlap to quite an extent. Let me give you an example of an intervention simulation on a problem. This comes from Batty's book on cities and complexity. Towards the end, he gives an example of intervention at a London street fair, I think the Nottingham Hill event, in which they're very concerned about assaults that resulted presumably from crowding. There was an effort by Batty and his people working with the London Metropolitan Police and a lot of others presumably. They looked at different ways that the crowds formed with various alternative simulation approaches. And with the idea of rerouting a parade thing to change the way the crowds move. And from that, they then redesigned the parade routing scheme, which presumably then reduced the crowding, which would then reduce the assaults, and so forth. So in that case, the analysts are working directly with police and other people to address a particular problem. Another example might be, how would the closing off of a street access, a street barricade, or changing a street from one way to two way, or vice versa, change the flow of traffic, which would then influence crime? Would making a neighborhood less permeable to traffic reduce burglaries in that neighborhood, for example? And one could simulate that as a specific problem and suggest possible alternative approaches. Imagine that a simulation of this neighborhood would say, well, closing streets A, B, and C will have little or no effect. Closing streets D, E, and F could have major effects, right? So it would help direct attention to which streets make more sense closing. I'm very interested in place management issues, as Marcus mentioned, and one might experimentally vary how one addresses landlords and their willingness to kick people out, to enforce regulations on their property and so forth. Let me sort of summarize this role of the analysis unit here. As you can see, I got getting carried away with drawing and this. It was one of those things where as I got more and more into it, I got more and more gleeful, and at the end I said, what the hell is this thing? But it's fun doing it. The standard model of policing is no analysis. Patrols wander around, right? And you can vary how many people are wandering around. Or they go to the most recent crime. Those are the core elements to it. You could also create an investigation component that would be analogous to that. My little police car, it took about 20 minutes a trip to put together. With a focused policing, you start with some array of crime events, and you analyze it with the crime analysis, then looks at it and comes up with some notion of some hot spot, right? And the police sit on it. Okay. Again, broad brush, but I think it sort of gets to the point. The analysis is basically looking at spatial temporal clustering, and you patrol the clusters. And with problem-oriented policing, you've got this confusion array of all sorts of things. The triangles represent the crime triangles Marcus mentioned before, and you can find out more about this at the OP website. So you have both this element here, which is like what's going on with the focus policing, but in addition, you've got more information coming from outside sources. So you might get information from a public health authority, it might be qualitative information, it might be information from schools, it might be information from the planning unit, who knows? All sorts of possible information sources come in. In the original problem detection thing that the basic crime analysis does feeds into this also, and here's a little spot of the magnifying glass, focusing on one side of that triangle, saying, aha, this is the aha moment right here. We should focus on this side of the triangle and then go after that clustering in that way. So that's in a quick synopsis of the role of analysis sort of captures how I would envision this being an important part of it. The important thing, as I mentioned earlier, is that this notion of exploring the triangle is, in essence, what the police are trying to do is simulate that problem themselves. So it builds in the simulation of a simulation into the whole thing. Yes?
Just go across that slide again.
Sure, if I can figure out how to go backwards.
I get that that's a line bulb, but what's that carefully constructed purple thing?
That's supposed to be a police cap. Yeah. You're from Britain. You wouldn't understand that. Yeah. It was one of those long and tubular things, right? And you don't use stars either.
So that's the aha voila model.
Yeah. So anyway, yes.
Police operations, as we've heard of Asian, we all know, are extremely diverse.
Yes.
What do you think about the level of granularity you need and the kind of scope of the problem in order to be useful? I mean, you talk about standard models and so on. And, fast response is very useful for some types of crimes.
Yes. If you have a true emergency, you definitely want it.
Domestic violence, for example. You want to get there as soon as possible so that you can prevent violence.
Yep.
Silent alarms and so on. And then there's many other types of crimes in which, if you're 2 hours late, you can still collect all the data.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how if you could start chopping and dividing, and every time you do that, you've got to have another manual simulation work and so on and so forth. Do you think this is a feasible thing to do? How much detail do you have to stick in there before it starts?
Well, in my prior life, when I was actually working in Washington, partly for the police, this problem would seem to be insurmountable, and I would get very desperate about it because I wanted results right away. But now I'm in academia, and I think, hey, this is great. This is like lifetime employment for me and all my students and the students, right? So, as flip as that sounds, I think the granularity thing raises a whole nother level of things, because you're absolutely right. Even with the standard model, there are a lot of forms of that one could look at, and one would want to have a lot of different types of simulations of even the same thing using different simulation techniques to make sure you're not just building in the error of the particular simulator at that moment. I think this is a long-term project. I don't see this as a couple people sit down, do one or two simulations, come up with the results, and everybody says, hey, we've got it, let's move on to the next topic. As I've indicated about problem-oriented policing, the number of types of problems, Ron Clark and I one time just did a very initial cut at classifying police problems, and we came up with, I think it was something like 66 discrete types of problems. But even each of those types are so broad that I estimated one time in a draft that we had, hundreds of thousands, if not millions or billions of discrete problems. And the number came so outrageous that Ron said, don't even publish that. But, you know, so there's, and then the types of interventions for any one particular problem would be quite varied. There's not one key to every lock in this world. There are multiple keys to these locks. So there's a lot of ways of doing this thing. So the answer is you would want a lot of granularity. Problem specificity is very important. But that what that means this is a lot needs a lot more people than in this room doing this, a lot more time, spending a lot more of your money, right? Marcus, did you have a
question? Yeah, I just want to say the website, propcenter.org, really has not only, it has, 60 different specific templates, but within them, there are ways to look at your specific local problem for farther brain. And so I think there's enough there for people to work with if they have a local problem or simulation.
Right.
Can you say a few problems, give an example of what we mean by problems in problem learning, please?
Yeah, well, let me illustrate the problem-specific guide that I'm working on with one of my graduate students now on pedestrian vehicle accidents. The student I was working with came up with, I think, on the order of 20 discrete types of interventions that could plausibly work on some circumstances. None of them will work on every circumstance. That's for one kind of problem. If you look at reducing student drinking riots, there are similarly 15 to 20 kinds of interventions that you could mix and match, depending on your students and the way that the riots were likely to come about. Street-level drug dealing is one of the problem-specific guides. Even that is too broad a term because street-level drug dealing has a lot of different forms. My mind boggles. But basically, if you think of a particular kind of place and a particular kind of behavior that people find objectionable, and you sort of marry those two things together, you can imagine a lot of different kinds of things. I was telling people at lunch today that I joke with my students that the distribution of crime is probably not all that different than the distribution of dog do on the street. And we don't normally think of dog do as a crime, but in the world I operate in my neighborhood, it is probably the highest level of crime you're going to run into or step on. Just that, you know, how would you handle that issue is to me as equally important to look at as any number of other things. Homicides, varied types. In Cincinnati, we've got a lot of homicides dealing with disrespect issues around that, which are going to be different from homicides dealing with robbing a 7-Eleven or a gas station or something like that.
But the main thing I think for people that are new to the field to understand is that if there are several assaults in and around a certain bar, that Joe's bar is the problem, even if there are different crimes that may be break-ins, some of them are break-ins, but really Joe's bar is the problem, or a couple of bars like that.
Well, we can look at this in a number of ways that a particular type of situation can give rise to multiple types of problems, and going after that particular common situation can reduce a variety of problems. But the other thing is that you've got multiple problems overlaying in space and time with each other, which may only be related in space and time, but have nothing else in common. And solving one of them doesn't do anything for solving the others. One of the things I didn't mention about problem-oriented policing is that fundamentally it characterizes policing different than these other two. The other two, for the most part, they think of police as about crime and disorder. Problem-oriented policing thinks about crime and disorder as being a subset of things the police are interested in. The police, basically, from a problem-oriented policing perspective, are the single 24-hour agency with command and control approaches that have the capability of dealing with anything that nobody else has dealt with successfully in the past. Right? So everything left over, everything that everyone has refused to do, right, or can't do, or hadn't thought about doing, the police end up with. Right? And so that if kids don't get educated, don't go to school, who handles it? Well, it's not teachers, it's the police. Right? It may not have anything to do. So people talk, well, we got a truancy problem. Well, truancy is a status position. But the police are called to do something about truancy, not because it is necessarily crime-related. People will call it crime-related in order to get your attention, but if it had not, they may not be involved in any kind of crime. It's just they're not in school and no one else is out there to do something about it. How am I doing for time?
Oh, you've got about 10 minutes left.
Okay, so if you think about it in those terms, the modeling of policing from a problem order to is it becomes a pretty vast exercise. And I think one might have to chop that down into some a variety of forms. Almost anything that where there's a failure to address something ends up in the police hands one way or the other. And even if it does, in a Western society, most medical issues don't end up in police hands. One can imagine a number of other societies where they do. There's nothing. It's a catch-all agency. And the reason they carry guns is because a lot of the reasons that people don't do the things they should do is because you have to force them to do it. that's in some simple way. That's how I see policing. I mean, go ahead.
There's a lot of different kinds of simulation. Have you kind of given thought to what you'd recommend using for those officers?
Oh God, no. I mean, I said at the beginning, Jeff is sort of got me interested in thinking about this thing, and I sort of went into it grudgingly. And now I think there's actually the more interesting stuff there. But how the specific form of the simulations would take, I haven't a clue. And there's some things which I've sort of hinted at. Some of the spatial simulation stuff I've tend to focus on because I tend to think spatially, despite the fact I have no training in that area. Some of these things, like networks, for example, I just sort of hinted at because I have a gut instinct that that would be another approach to looking at it. I'm sure that any number of you who know a lot of different other models might say, aha, we could use blah, blah, blah to do that, and I'd say, fine. Sole criteria has is that it actually produces something in the end that is useful. But other than that, I don't care. I'm very pragmatic about this, and I think we're too early to actually rule things out. My only concern is that people are not naive and stop standard modeling, and they're not naive in assuming that the data is actually a good depiction of what's going on in reality. It might be, but we won't know that.
Yeah, a mathematician many years ago in London predicted the probability of a police phone ran a patrol coming within 100 yards of residential burglary, and it turned out to be once every 8 years. So essentially, if you have people on random patrol, do you increase that by putting more patrol officers out there? And what happens, of course, is you increase the probability of being within 100 yards of residential burglary more if you find out where there's a cluster of burglaries,
right.
And then you focus the patrol on that area, not increasing patrol in general, but focus patrol. That's sort of the simulation type thing that you could do mathematically.
There's sort of a rule of thumb which I discovered the other day when talking to some of my friends who focused in corrections and rehabilitation area, and they were telling me, and I was surprised by this, that you get the most bang for your buck by rehabilitating the worst offenders. Don't worry about the ones who are basically only lightly involved. We tend to think, well, they're only lightly involved, we can rescue them before it's too late. Chances are most of those people are going to get out of crime anyway, right? Go after the worst. And it turns out to be true in policing, too. The place that you want to put your patrol is where the most crime is. Can't drive little crime down to zero. I mean, it's you don't have much room to drive it. If you have a lot of crime, you can drive it farther. So the rule of thumb is treat the worst first, and then the second worst. And if the repeat victimization is another good example of it. Go after the people who've already been victimized, don't worry too much about the people who haven't been, and then work your way down.
That fits George's work, too, on go after the worst drug markets, don't do a triage.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a simple rank order. Yeah.
Other questions, but could I ask one first?
Sure.
If you go back to your prior slide, this is somewhat tied to your very first question was asked.
Oh, why do people like this slide? I had so much fun doing it.
If you go to the standard model, and then you go to the focus model, you're talking about spatiotemporal. This isn't coming across a crime in progress, because that is extremely rare. But if you didn't have too many police, and you had a clustering of crime, and then the fact that they're responding to the calls would put them in the crime areas. So going back to your first question, if your police were limited in number, you might have focused policing without having to do any analysis.
Perhaps, but I mean, if you think about the reality of the situation, let's think of a rural area, let's say the RCMP is patrolling in the rural areas, where crime is not gonna be, I mean, it might be clustered when looked at from space, but up close, right, these locations that could actually be hit are gonna be widely dispersed. So I think in practice, if this was a large urban area, you would be right, but it wouldn't happen that way in a large urban area.
Which has always been one of the arguments with, because patrol is such a common law mm-hmm. thing, and except research showing that it has no value, people have always argued you should do something similar to replace ambulances.
Yeah.
Minimize response time, but if that matters.
Yeah.
But yes, sir. Next question, I'm sorry.
You talked about the not wanting to do any simulation of community policing and so on, and I understand some reasons for that, but you know, there's been a certain amount of experiential reports about community policing being done by a certain city and so on, and the crime rate goes up. Not because the police are no longer mm-hmm. doing investigations and so on, but because they're building trust and your reporting filter
mm-hmm.
becomes less
right.
So,
yeah, and if one could take that, even let's say we don't even have strong evidence one way or the other about it, but if one could take that notion and then build one or more concrete mechanisms for how that would translate it, and we could then imagine how one could operationalize this in a simulation, I'd be all for it. But notice what you've done is taken community policing from this broad thing, you've narrowed it down to a very specific question about a specific thing. Under those situations, I think doing this kind of modeling works. But my concern is not that community policing shouldn't be simulated, it's just that we haven't done the basic work that would make that simulation productive at this point. And if someone is interested in it, they should do that first, and then this problem could work very well.
Yeah, so I don't have any thoughts of my own, as I proved with speaking for Jeff this morning. So, Mike or Neil, you're going to be on the spot here. And Sid, you all at lunch today were talking about the sheep herder and the dogs and the wolves and all of that sort of stuff. Haven't we thought about models that would fit in with the policing? And would you say anything about them?
I was just talking about, I mean, that sounds like an agricultural model, but it sheep, dogs, wolves, you've got some...
I have a Welsh corgi, so I'm really interested in sort of how that
is. So you're trying to, you know, a simple problem, you've got simple to state, hard to solve. You've got something you're trying to protect, sheep that are wandering around in a manner that you can't necessarily control, and you've got wolves that are out there that are sniffing out the sheep. And this makes it different from a diffusion problem, you see, because it's directed diffusions.
Right.
And you've got some limited number of dogs. What do you do with your dogs? Do you program them to sniff out the wolves? Do you program them to circle the sheep?
Yeah.
Or circle certain subsets of the sheep that have been attacked by wolves before? So this is a problem we've got underway, and it's a problem in actually physics.
How has this problem been solved? Because actually, people haven't solved it.
Well, you know, obviously, apart from sitting on networks rather than 2D systems, so we've sat it on social networks.
Yeah.
You know, the types of networks
that
move around them. So obviously, you can go through this simulation to solve it analytically. Well, we may not want to solve it analytically. you know, it depends. If you've got a very well connected network, it's like a fully mixed problem. It's like an epidemiological problem. Everything's mixed, so it's a so-called mean field limit. It doesn't matter about the structure. But as soon as you start getting down to sparse numbers, it really matters then whether the, you know, it's kind of obvious, but you know, whether the sheep are on the hub and the wolves are working out where the hub is, or so.
Right.
Our question was, is it best to send your dogs after the sheep or after the wolves? And
in some sense, that's a fair characterization of a lot of the debate in policing. Does one go after the repeat offenders, or does one protect the potential victims? And I mean, in a practical matter, it's more of how you mix that portfolio, because you never do one or the other. The problem we have is that although the going after the wolves seems to make sense, the evidence just doesn't exist. Again, I have to caution, it's not that it's, the evidence is against it, it just, the evidence is not there. There is a little bit of evidence that suggests on if you use highly specific deterrent mechanisms, something like was used in Boston for Operation Ceasefire, going after the wolves actually makes a difference. But in that particular case, the wolves and the sheep were the same people.
Right, so that's interesting. When you start to turn sheep, wolves into, well, we
wolves
were
attacking wolves.
We were turning dogs into wolves,
yeah,
who were worried,
yeah,
about corruption in the police.
Yeah. Well, that's another issue altogether.
It's very interesting because if you start sending two dogs, you know, if you send a dog after a wolf, you know, do you send a dog to check on the dog after a wolf?
Yeah.
I mean, sorry, it sounds
like. How many dogs do you send?
Yeah. But that gets into a whole bunch. That gets into a whole problem. What do you do with a dog poo afterwards?
Yeah.
So. Well, I actually. Those, I think, are very interesting types,
yeah,
of issues that one have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, you know, I've talked about sort of the problems and error in the data from the perspective of finding spatial crime patterns. The same issues, and maybe even more so, exist in finding offender networks. Because we really don't have full information about this, no matter, you know, if you're dealing with informants, they, not only is it missing information, they have a real incentive to lie and overreact or and any number of other things. So that we, in order to do some of this, one would have to say, okay, what is the simulation of lying among informants? You know, and how could we model that in some way that would help us calibrate these things? I don't know. I mean, there might be ways that somebody has in some other discipline which could say, oh yeah, well, that fit perfectly.
Last question.
I think one of the bottlenecks in applying this type of work is that we are not so well informed about, say, the first stage of your simulation.
Mm-hmm.
What is happening there when somewhere else, yeah, something is happening? So all these, if you have these dogs doing something,
mm-hmm,
it may well be that both the sheep and the wolves perhaps also the environment in which they live, react on what's happening there. And of course, you have to make a lot of assumptions about that. And it's my impression that may be much more important part of the whole simulation circle than actually simulating what these police officers or the police dogs are doing. And I think we are, alas, not very well informed and of that part of our field of how the standard environment is reacting on a new style of policing.
So what you're saying is this part here.
Number
is
one is the critical,
yeah,
point.
Now, and that's an important point because I'm sort of talking about all the stuff that comes after that, but this conference is about really something very, very, very new, and which is about that. And I'm sort of saying, well, having solved that problem already, let's move on to 2, 3, 4 and this kind of stuff. Then I suppose if you brought someone in corrections, you could add a whole another layer in there as well. So there's a lot of work for people to do and had a lot of fun for quite a number of years. But anyway, I think we're done.